concealed carry on campus. It's a loaded topic that we're discussing right now. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for tuning in on this Monday. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a good weekend. Just ahead, keep listening because both sides will have their say on a hot topic. A measure that would allow concealed weapons on Florida's college campuses. Where do you stand? Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, a look at the new production, To the Seas, celebrating the rivers, creeks, and oceans of the First Coast. Plus, is Gus Bradley on the bubble as the Jaguars lose to Tampa Bay? Cole Pepper breaks down last night's loss. That's later in sports. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, legislation is moving ahead in Tallahassee that would allow concealed firearms on the state's college campuses. This, even though a new poll finds the majority of Floridians oppose allowing students to carry weapons on campus. Now, supporters of the campus carry bill, as it's called, argue it would make colleges safer. Opponents question the need to allow weapons in an already stress-filled college environment. The debate comes fresh on the heels of a mass shooting at an Oregon community college that killed 9 people and the gunman at the hands of police. Tonight, the One Jacks Institute will look at this issue from both sides as they present the next program in their Civil Discourse series. Tonight's event is called Gun Control, a Loaded Topic. This free event is taking place on the UNF campus. We've got a preview right now as we welcome UNF President John Delaney. He'll moderate tonight's forum. Good morning to you.
Morning, Melissa.
Also with us in studio, Cord Byrd, representative for the National Rifle Association.
Hi, good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you, Cord. And here's our question to callers. We'd like to know where you stand on the so-called campus carry bill, two measures moving forward in the state legislature that would allow concealed weapons on Florida's public colleges and university campuses. Let us know your thoughts, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us, or you can let us know what you think on Facebook. So, John Delaney, UNF president, you will be moderating tonight neutrally, but as the president of the university, you have spoken out on this topic before and gone on record as saying you're against the measure. Why is that?
Yeah, well, there's sort of one element. Tonight's debate is about guns in general and not necessarily guns on campus, although that I'm sure that's an element that will come up. But in terms of guns on campus, college kids and guns just aren't a good mix. And it's an emotional age, and some are experimenting with alcohol and drugs as much as we work to clamp down on that. I think the practical problem, and I was a prosecutor for 10 years, and when you see a shootout, it's not a pretty sight, is that if the police respond to a shooter in, say, a library, as happened at Florida State, if students are armed, the police aren't going to know who's the bad guy. And there's really a high risk of danger of other people being shot collaterally by the armed students. And so as a result, the university's police chiefs, the university's presidents just don't think it's a good step for us to go in this country.
Cord Byrd, representing the NRA, the legislature is moving ahead with these measures. Campus university presidents like Mr. Delaney are arguing against it. What's your point of view? You're advocating your position at the state capitol.
Sure, absolutely. And as an alumnus of UNF, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this tonight and for the university to be involved in this important dialogue. But we have to remember that these are adults. These are students that that many will have gone through the concealed carry permit classes. They will have gone through extensive background checks. They will have been fingerprinted. They will have gone through firearms training. So these are people who the legislature and the state government has thought we have granted them a concealed carry permit, and we think that they will be responsible in their use of the firearms.
John Delaney, you don't agree?
Yes, they're 18, 19. They are certainly adults, but they're not with their father on a hunting trip. They're not with a sergeant of the Army kind of monitoring their behavior. I do think Cord's correct that if you limit the access of guns to people that have gone through training, gone through some background checks more extensively than just allowing anyone to have a gun, that certainly makes it a little more palatable. But it's a huge risk. It's just simply a huge risk. And the shootings that we've seen at campuses across the country by mentally ill students or mentally ill young people is a real threat. And once again, I mean, I'm a hunter. I'm going up to South Dakota next month. I do strongly believe in the Second Amendment, but like all of our all of our Bill of Rights, there's some restrictions. I know that you're probably a passionate believer in the First Amendment and the freedom of the press, but there's some limitations on defamation, and you know, criminal defense lawyers are strong proponents of the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, but they're not universal, and so I think that some modest limitations is actually healthier for the country. Understanding that you simply can't ban guns in this country, that it's not legal and it's not practical.
Let me ask you as a follow-up: didn't a UNF student push for the right to allow legal permission for her to carry her weapon on campus in her vehicle?
In her car, correct, and she did win that lawsuit.
So where do you? What about that aspect of this?
Well, we also the state allowed universities to ban people from having guns in their vehicles. We limited that only to students, so employers, visitors could have guns in their vehicle. But the court's spoken on it. The legislature is not going to modify the language. The legislature, when it passed it, had an exception so that universities, colleges, preschool, daycares, K-12, primary, secondary, post-secondary institutions could say, no, we're going to have a carve-out. But the language was drafted poorly, and the first district ruled that universities can no longer tell anybody that they can't have a gun in the trunk of their car.
And is it hypocritical to say to students, well, you can carry a gun in your vehicle, but not on your person?
No, I don't think so. I mean, again, it's you know, students mature physically, or kids mature physically in their teens. Mentally, though, the brain's still growing up until age 30, and you move from emotional thought to rational thought. And with the fact that the country's got a drinking problem among young and a drug problem among young and a mental health issue, we just think that this is just throwing a match to gasoline.
And Cord, let me ask you, almost three quarters of Floridians, 73%, according to a new University of South Florida poll, oppose allowing students with concealed weapons permits to carry guns on campus. According to a new survey, Floridians were asked about a number of issues. This was overwhelmingly the only issue that the vast majority of Floridians agreed on. Widespread bipartisan agreement. What about that?
Well, I think first we have to look at how the question's framed. And second, when people are given the facts, when they understand what will be allowed and what will not be allowed, I think those numbers will change. And what's really important to remember about this debate, especially with keeping firearms in the automobiles on campus, UNF, when I was there, and I think it still is a commuter campus. And so students are studying there in the library late at night, then they have to travel home. If they break down on the way home, how are they going to defend themselves? And I don't think the university can prevent them from being able to defend themselves when they're traveling to and from the school. Or if they're the students who live on campus, no different than the students who live off campus, they're allowed to keep a firearm in their home to defend their life and property against criminal wrongdoing.
Yeah, we're no longer a commuter school. We're a residential campus and have 3,500 kids that live on campus. But that law is settled. The students can have cars in their vehicles. That one's over despite anybody's particular position. I think the issue is if a student's sitting in a classroom, if he doesn't like, he or she doesn't like a grade they're getting from a professor, if they're in the dorms at night and have an emotional breakdown, it's just having the ready accessibility on a college campus or, frankly, in a private high school or a private junior high or a daycare. Right now, students or employers can have guns in those particular areas.
Regardless of whether the law changes, there have been incidents on campus. Just Sunday, a University of South Florida football player was arrested on charges that he fired a gun at a campus dorm. 21-year-old reserve offensive lineman Benjamin Knox of DeLand, according to campus police, fired at the dorm from a parking garage. Guns already are on campus. So let me ask both of you where you stand in terms of whether changing the statute would affect what is already the reality of guns on our state's college campuses. Cord?
Sure. We look at this issue in every one of these school shootings, whether it's Virginia Tech or it's Oregon, we had defenseless, helpless students who could do nothing. They could do absolutely nothing to defend themselves. And the shooters had free rein, and they knew they had free rein because the campuses are gun-free zones. If we had students who have gone through the training, gone through background checks, many of these students are veterans who at 18 years old, the nation said, here, we're going to give you a gun and you can go fight for your country. Why should we prohibit those individuals from being on campus and allowing them to protect not only themselves but other students in the event that some insane criminal wants to go in and shoot up a classroom?
I think that's a good point. I think the problem, though, is the practical aspect of how that would play out. If you think of a crowded library and somebody coming in wearing blue jeans and a T-shirt and starts shooting people, and somebody else pulls a gun out and starts shooting at that person, they're not going to hit every time. But bullets will be flying. Police arrive on the scene. Everybody's got a gun. It's the practical aspect of that that is the issue. Being able to carry a concealed permit through the rest of your life, other parts of your life, all across town, I think that's legitimate. College campus, different story. And much like any of our Bill of Rights, any of those protections, there's some limitations and some restrictions. And I think this is clearly one that the public obviously thinks, and we'll see where the legislature goes.
Will you lobby the legislature on this on this issue? Will you go to Tallahassee?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We've actively lobbied it the last few years, and we'll continue to do so.
And as will the NRA, already has been.
Absolutely.
Let's go to your calls right now, 549-2937, Teresa in Jacksonville. Hi, Teresa. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
I'm calling. I've actually heard y'all speak about this a few times. I am a UNF student. I've never called into a radio station before, but I really wanted to voice my opinion. I have four other brothers and sisters who are also in college. And when we hear this subject, we all cringe. Our father does, carry a concealed weapon. But I do not feel safer knowing that there are more guns on my campus. It makes me more concerned. I would prefer that there be maybe more police officers or more metal detectors, more trained individuals who can respond to a problem. Knowing that another 20-something-year-old kid in my class has a gun on him does not make me feel protected. It makes me tense. It concerns me.
All right. That's Teresa calling, from the UNF campus. Or Cord Bird, what about her concern as a UNF student?
Oh, and those are real concerns. And the NRA understands that. And those who are proponents of the bill understand those concerns. But we know what happens when the college campuses are gun-free zones. And as you pointed out correctly, students are already taking guns on campuses, whether the university or the police know it or not. And this is a way to let law-abiding, trained students carry their weapons when we already know that other students are already carrying them.
Otis in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Otis.
Yes, good morning. I have a question. Here's the question is this, Jeff. I hope to see people always use an analogy. Our military, but when the military don't walk around on base having arms strapped to their side unless you're about to deploy, if by chance they say that we can have weapons in the classroom, why not dictate the type of weapons? Why not a lone gun, single shot? Because someone will get killed if everybody is able to just rapidly fire at an object and don't know where it's coming from. Unnecessary death will occur.
Sure, mentioning the military bases, I think there's now going to be a push to arm the soldiers on bases, as we've seen shootings on military bases because the members of the military weren't armed on the bases or the recruiting stations. So I think we're probably going to see a change in that law as well.
Here's a tweet from a listener. Can you name a mass shooting incident where the shooter said they chose the location because it's a gun-free zone?
It's my understanding that the shooter in Aurora, Colorado, drove past a movie theater that was not advertised as a gun-free zone to drive to a theater that was.
Well, he was suicidal in any event, and I think he anticipated being either shot or committing suicide. And I do think what does get lost in this debate is mental illness, that every one of these shooters had severe mental illness. And we've got to do better as a country. Number one on mental health in general, but particular the signals on some of these young people that they've got this propensity, and in that case look to, and I imagine the NRA supports this, in that case look to make sure that someone in those conditions is not able to get access to a gun. But the push really is even more broadly, an NRA-related affiliate is pushing to allow students at the University of Florida to have guns in the dorm rooms. that's not a good idea. Whether it's just it makes it easier to commit suicide or easier to shoot somebody that's dating an ex-girlfriend or a boyfriend or the ex-girlfriend or boyfriend. It's just a rough situation when the students are really separated from parents and not really being monitored by sergeants and lieutenants and captains and colonels.
Cord.
Once again, the guns are already there. I mean, suicides are already taking place on campuses. This is about arming trained individuals who can prevent. And this, you know, the media focuses on when there's a tragedy. But month after month, the NRA publishes incidents of armed individuals using firearms to save themselves and others. This happens every single day in America, but those stories don't make the news. And so we know.
Do you have examples of those?
I don't have them with me, but I can certainly bring them tonight. I mean, every month in the NRA American Shooter magazine, there are replete with probably 15 to 20 examples every single month, and I've been an NRA member for 20 years, of incidents where armed citizens are defending themselves and saving lives, but those stories don't get reported widely in the media. It's only the tragedies.
I'm going to imagine that that's in somebody's home, as opposed to, well, they're driving down the highway or they're in a convenience store or something like that. And again, my point is the risk of having someone being able to randomly shoot back. Just within the past week, there was a shoplifter at a Home Depot or a Lowe's that ran out of the store and threw this stuff in the back of a waiting SUV, and a customer coming out of her car shot at the vehicle and shot out the tire, but the vehicle got away. Well, there's a recklessness to that. There's such a danger to the rest of the citizenry, and that is in a place where she was legitimately able to carry the weapon. She was did have a concealed weapon permit.
Here's a lot of feedback coming in on social media. David emails the show, with all due respect, John Delaney's argument that UNF students are immature 18-year-olds isn't always correct. The average age, according to the website, is 5 years older, sometimes 23 years old, and lots of tweets coming in. Here's one from Michael. When the politicians allow guns in congressional chambers, the White House, and city halls, then maybe you have an argument. Let's go now to...
I didn't say immature, by the way. I didn't use that word. And what we are talking about is that the thousands of freshmen that live on campus, as well as sophomores and juniors, that are pretty much the traditional age.
But your argument being that their brains are not fully developed.
Well, it's an emotional time. It's an emotional time. College is an emotional, stressful time. You know, you worry about money. You worry about grades. Schizophrenia tends to develop at around age 20 to 22. And it appears that most of these campus shooters have mental illness akin to schizophrenia.
Let's go to Gail in St. Augustine. Hi, Gail. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm very much in favor of the position of President John Delaney, and I'm very glad that you're being a strong advocate to keep guns off of campuses. I think it is a complete mistake to bring more guns into this environment. I think you will have, there's an issue with sort of impulse control sometimes, not with all young people, but certainly there are a great number of people that do have, you know, an impulse control issue, as I'm sure from other discussions of mental health and kids on, you know, Ritalin and other drugs to help them to cope with things. This is a very stressful time. Like you say, grades are stressful, wanting to achieve what your parents are hoping for you, and failures and concerns, all the romantic issues that arise at this age. And I'm very concerned if, say, some, you know, perfectly trained person has, you know, their gun concealed in their backpack, and then this other person can snatch it out and start shooting because, you know, they have gone over the edge as far as what they're able to control that particular day, and whether it's shooting at a teacher or another student or committing suicide. Having more guns in this environment is just a terrible mistake, and I really applaud President Delaney for arguing and lobbying so strongly against it. Thank you.
All right. That's Gail in St. Augustine. So we're getting a sampling of some of the arguments that will come up tonight. Cord Bird, John Delaney, you'll be joined by people representing both sides of the argument. Now, as you said at the start of this discussion, this will be one aspect of a wider debate around gun control in this country, right?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. What else do you expect to come up tonight?
Well, I think that the president's proposing executive orders on guns, which there's a debate on whether he can do that or not. Many of the presidential candidates have weighed in. So this is a national conversation, and it's one that I hope that we can continue and talk about, not just when there's a tragedy, because that's when we are at our most emotional. And this is a topic that it involves constitutional law and individual rights and liberties and freedoms, and it's not one that we can make emotionally. We need to make it based on rationality and the facts.
I agree with Cord. And sort of moving the debate beyond just the guns on campus, there's really a cultural divide in this country about guns. And, I've got friends that view guns as if you're keeping a dangerous snake. You go to where I'm going next month, South Dakota, a gun is viewed as a hammer or a saw. It's a tool. And the idea of limiting access to those, it's alien to people in, say, the West and some of the more rural areas of the country. And so that's what we hope to flesh out tonight. It's going to have it balanced both ways and let both sides sort of air the beliefs and the thinking. And we'll challenge each side and hopefully we'll have a civil discussion. As we have this morning.
Yes, and I appreciate that very much, gentlemen. Thank you so much for being with us this morning, and it's sure to be a good program this evening.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks a lot.
We were joined by UNF President John Delaney and an NRA Representative Cord Byrd. He is a candidate for House District 11. That's Janet Atkins' current seat. She is termed out in the Florida House. Also joining the One Jacks Institute program tonight, Gun Control, a Loaded Topic, will be Patricia Brigham, chair of the Gun Safety Committee for League of Women Voters of Florida, Richard Collier, former NFL offensive lineman. He is the founder of the Spirit Strong Foundation, a gun violence victim. Eric Friday with Florida Carry and criminal trial lawyer William Shepard. Again, this forum is tonight on the UNF campus at the Fine Arts Center. It is free and open to the public. But tickets are required, so visit
just
the
an e-ticket, correct? Yeah, yes. You just go online and get it.
Yeah, go to the One Jacks website and get your ticket for this free event. Much more still ahead. Later, whispers grow around Gus Bradley's fate as the Jaguars lose to Tampa. We'll also preview a new original production in Jacksonville, To the Sea. But up next, coming out with Jasmine. Back in a moment.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Failure is just a normal part of doing business, you know.
If you asked me at the beginning of Tesla, would I have thought that we'd be here, I would have said no. I thought we'd most likely not succeed. I thought we'd most likely die.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Tesla CEO Elon Musk, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
WJCT, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT-TV and radio. Submit now through November 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Welcome back. Well, the First Coast Connect Book Club returns later this month with a discussion of writer David McCullough's biography of the Wright brothers. You can check out a free copy of the book from the Jacksonville Public Library. We are proud to say they are our partner for the book club here on the show. Or pick up a copy from Chamberlain's or the Book Nook. Now, we want you to be part of the book club by sending us your thoughts about your very first flight. Send them to bookclub@wjct.org. How old were you when you first got on an airplane? What are your memories of the flight? Were they good or bad or exciting? What are your memories? What did it look like? What did it sound like? Just email your thoughts and we'll read them on the air during our next book club segment. Well, it's an event emphasizing hope, safety, inclusion, and equal treatment, and this area's increasingly diverse workforce. It's all part of Jasmine's annual Coming Out Day breakfast coming up this Friday on the UNF campus. Here in studio, we welcome Jasmine Executive Director Cindy Watson with a preview. Good to see you.
Good morning, Melissa.
Now, the keynote speaker will be Kevin Jennings, Executive Director of the Arcus Foundation, and he's going to be talking about bullying in schools, especially as it pertains to LGBT kids.
That's right.
Sure to be a powerful talk.
Well, it is. Kevin Jennings has a really long and distinguished career as an activist and social justice activist, a teacher. He actually is the person who founded the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, excuse me, back in 1990. And that is the group that supports gay-straight alliances across the country. And you may know, Melissa, that Jasmine has a student support project so that we support locally teenagers who are starting their gay-straight alliance clubs in their high schools. So we're excited about making that connection with Kevin Jennings.
The Coming Out Day breakfast has really come a long way over the years, hasn't it?
This is our ninth year. And the first year we had just a little over 100 folks there. The second year was the year 2008 when the economy was dipping. And so many of our lead sponsors were banks that were themselves in crisis. But we've come through all of that. We are sold out this week. We have over 400 people coming. We have companies like Deutsche Bank and Wells Fargo and Citi, who are our lead sponsors. And actually, we're excited this year because the Dolores Barr Weaver Event Fund is sponsoring this event. And so that's another really exciting kind of sponsor.
Now, you mentioned major corporate sponsors. A big aspect of this event is celebrating this area's diverse workforce. Tell us about that.
That's right. Well, really, the corporate community has led the way in terms of promoting equality for LGBT people. The corporate community, a lot of the big companies here in Jacksonville, I've already mentioned the three lead sponsors, but Florida Blue, Baptist Health, TD Bank, Vistar, a lot of these companies, Comcast, have really done a great effort at creating anti-discrimination policies and partner benefits that really support the LGBT community. They really know the business case for LGBT equality, both in terms of their own employees and their customers and making a difference in the community.
And when you talk about a coming out day, will people actually be coming out at this event?
Oh, that's a great question. Actually, National Coming Out Day is an anniversary of the first March on Washington back in 87. And so in 88, the LGBT leaders in the community said, we need to be out and we need to be visible so people know us. And so every year since then, folks in the LGBT community have made effort to come out, to be visible. So this breakfast is a chance for our allies to come out and to be open and out and supportive. So certainly there'll be people who are out who may never have come to a public event like this before, as well as, excuse me, as our allies.
Now, we live in 2015 across the country. Same-sex marriage has been legalized.
That's right.
In Jacksonville, there is still a lot of conversation about updating the city's human rights ordinance to cover LGBT citizens. Do you expect that issue to come up at this event?
The issue about the human rights ordinance comes up at every event because it's on everyone's mind in Jacksonville, particularly the LGBT community and our allies. People really feel like it's time that Jacksonville move forward with this ordinance. So while it's not a major theme of this breakfast, I'm sure that some of our speakers or our guests will make mention of it.
Again, it's the ninth annual Coming Out Day breakfast. Cindy Watson, Executive Director of Jasmine. This event is sold out, so can't get tickets, but thanks for telling us about it anyway.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
WJCT is proud to be your number one preset for your evening commute. But if you only turn on 89.9 when you're driving, here's what you're missing.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for
listening. This is The World.
Spend your afternoons with WJCT for unique conversations about the topics of the day. Join us weekdays from 2 to 6 for The Takeaway, The World, and All Things Considered. It's the smart way to spend your afternoon.
On the next Fresh Air, fashion designer Donna Karan tells us how creating clothes for herself and her friends led to her influential fashion line. She has a new memoir. And the popular comic strip Bloom County with Opus the Penguin is back. We talk with creator Berkeley Breathed about returning to the strip after 25 years and what Harper Lee has to do with it. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Follow what's happening at WJCT even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT FM at wjct.org/listen or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
Listeners love Relax Radio.
Hi, I'm Evan Willman. I typically listen to the station when I'm in my my home office. I work out of my house a lot. I have my HD radio in there. So this is really the best of all worlds. It gives me my news. It gives me music that constantly delights and surprises me.
When you make a $120 gift to WJCT, you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to Relax. Call 904-353-9528 for more information.
Welcome back. Well, like the creek, the river, and the sea that connect our community, a new collaboration tells the story of a boy, a man, and an elder, and their connection to the waters of the First Coast. To the Sea is a new production commissioned by Players by the Sea, and it's part of Jacksonville's Year of the River initiative. Now, this new play is inspired by renowned river advocate Jim Alabiso. He's known, of course, for swimming the St. John's River many times and founding the advocacy group Jumping Fish. To the Sea will see its debut at the Cummer Museum next week. Playwright Kelby Siddons and Jim Alabiso join us now with a preview. Hi, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to see you both.
Thanks. Good to see you, too.
Now, Jim, I see on Facebook all the time when you go swimming in the ocean, you always post a really beautiful picture of the ocean sunrise, and you write, To the Sea.
To the
so
sea.
That's where this all began, right?
Sure, yeah. I've been doing that for years. And Joe Schwartz over at Players by the Sea called me up about a year or so ago and wanted to explore some of the stories about the river and the ocean. And the working title was To the Sea and ended up being To the Sea, yeah.
So from that, Kelby, you worked up an original play. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So through some conversations with Jim, he shared his stories with me from many chapters of his life. And I also reflected myself on sort of what the water has meant to me growing up from kind of a nautical family. And in our first meeting together over in San Marco, I kind of told his story back to him with a theatrical treatment. And I didn't know at the time that was an interview. I thought we were just getting down to work. But that's what we ended up doing. He really liked the idea. And so now we have sort of his stories in three persons on stage, a boy, a man, and an elder, as you said. And together, they knit together and they tell his story of just about the human relationship with water.
So we learn about you, Jim, as well. We learn a little bit more about Jim Alabiso.
Well, we don't say much. It's not really a bio. It's more about human relationship with water. But yeah, I mean, there are a lot of my stories as a young man and a middle-aged guy and an old guy like I am.
You're not old. You're not old. And what are you, 30, 32, something like that?
Double
right?
that. And, yeah,
no, you're so vibrant. But let me ask you, water is obviously so important to you.
Sure.
Being near the water, being in the water. Why is that? What is your connection to the water?
I think it was because I was born on Shore Road in Brooklyn on the Hudson River. I think I could hear it from my crib, and that just programmed me for the rest of my life. But I grew up around water by creeks and streams and lakes and rivers. And for me, I mean, it was a recovery process for me because I got in a really bad accident in 2004 4, and I use swimming to recover. So it's always been a healing process for me. So while we were advocating for the St. John's River, it was more of a, it was kind of a parallel recovery for me. So, and always being close to the water, I just found it a healing process.
And water is healing for so many people, sure. Kelby. That's sort of a theme of this production. And also, it fits in with the overarching theme of the Year of the River, this whole initiative in Jacksonville to celebrate the St. John's River and to celebrate trying to make it healthier.
Absolutely. I think one of our reasons for putting together the piece, and of course the timing of it, is to try to unite people in one room and kind of commune and remind ourselves that we belong to the river and the river belongs to us and we have a responsibility, but also that we can take such joy from being in nature. I think too often we are so distracted by technology and other happenings that we forget that there is this primal essential connection to the world outside of our, you know, smartphone screen or the window.
So this celebrates our water-based community, and this is sort of adding, too, to the local theater scene in Jacksonville.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're really grateful to Players by the Sea for their support. I work with a lovely little community of playwrights here. We call ourselves the Groundling Scribes. They've been instrumental in reading this piece and developing it. So it's a really exciting time in Jacksonville Theater in terms of original work. Kind of
and it's great, too, that Hope McMath and Emily over at the Cummer have been so good to us to let us perform it over there at the Terry Gallery.
Yeah. That's now, great. Jumping Fish, which you founded, Jim, and everybody knows that you swim the St. John's River to try to encourage people to get into the water. Mm-hmm. And when I see you on Facebook going into the ocean, how often are you – how often do you do the ocean swims?
Several times a week. We go every Sunday.
Every
Sunday. We have a tribe of folks that go out every Sunday at 9, and then we do sunrise swims once or twice a week. Sure, yeah.
Have you ever had any mishaps, like caught in a riptide? Any wild stories?
You'll hear about those in the show as well.
Do we? Really? Really? Yeah. Tell me.
Sure. Well, I mean, there are times when, like last Tuesday, for example, it was pretty rough out there. It was 7-8. Foot waves, very windy. The waves were lapping the bottom of the Jacksonville Pier, but we live for that.
Yeah,
right. I mean,
did you go out during Joaquin? Were you out there during all that?
Sure, yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
But you loved it.
Yes. Yeah. Sure. I mean, when like a mountain climber, you know, they're more excited about climbing a mountain rather than a hill, and we're more as an open water swimmer, which is a lot different than pool swimming. We're very excited about swimming, but you know, a lot of it has to do with endorphins.
So how do you feel after an ocean swim?
Oh, it feels great. I mean, those endorphins last for days. I mean, we do sunrise swims. You know, we're out of the water by 8:30 or so, and then we're on to work, and it's just a really good way to start the day. But it's also a good reminder, we really need to take care of the water. And part of the story is about taking care of the water. When I was a kid, I lived in the streams in the farmlands in New Jersey by a stream. And I remember the first oil slick I ever saw. And my first work of advocacy was as a 9-year-old because there was an oil slick. And then 1989, years and years later, I ended up working in Alaska on the Exxon spill.
Get out.
From 89, 90,
didn't know
and 91.
That about you.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was kind of, there's a lot of parallels in the story that connect from one era of my life to another.
To another.
Sure.
So, Kelby, there were three actors playing the three phases into the sea.
Yes.
Three talented men, a young guy, an adult man, and an older guy in this production.
Mm-hmm. So we have a brilliant young actor named Ben Ketchum portraying the boy. The characters aren't named. They're sort of archetypal, but Ben is playing the boy. Rick Watson is playing the man, and then the swimmer is David Guile, and I've been privy to their rehearsal process that's been happening, and it's starting to look really good. There's some very magical moments. I'm really excited for other people to see it.
I went to rehearsal the other day, and I lost the opening monologue. It was real. It's so touching. And Ben, we found out at rehearsal the other day that Ben actually knows one of the characters in the play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this was kind of, so there's kind of great
so
connections.
So exciting.
There.
Yeah. Well, get your tickets now for To the Sea, a new original production debuting October 21st at the Cummer Museum. Get your tickets at the Facebook event or at cummer.org. Now, we also want to mention something else while you're here, Jim.
Uh-huh.
This Thursday night, it's TV Jack's premiere night at the Sunray Cinema, an upfront event with our own First Coast Connect, the TV version.
Melissa Ross,
yes,
TV, yeah.
Tonight with Jim Alabiso, your show. Mm-hmm. Fashion Gone Local with
Joanna House.
Joanna House, mm-hmm, the famous Joanna House. And Swag with Nick Largen, a.k.a. iRock.
Yes.
New original shows debuting on TVJax.com and Digital 18.1. You need to come by the Sunray Cinema Thursday night for this really fun upfront event. That's going to be fun as well.
It'll be great. We're going to have a good time. We have a reception at 5:30, 6 o'clock. We're going to screen some trailers and teasers from our show and some segments, and then do some Q&A and talk back, and then off to Cask for some wine.
That's right. So you're a busy guy, Jim Alabiso.
Thank you.
Thanks. But we're having fun.
So again, To the Sea on October 21st. Go catch this provocative new debut, playwright Kelby Siddons. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having
us.
Culpepper's up next as Jags fans wonder about the fate of Gus Bradley. That's after this.
Life has enough drama.
Seems we've gotten a bad batch of grits, and we think it comes from Minnesota. They've made everyone feel gloomy and guilty.
Oh. And reality.
Can we not do this? Can we just not do this?
I'm going to have a practice funeral. Right?
Find a way to forget your troubles.
With ping pong, trap shooting, hopscotch.
And gather some friends around the radio this weekend.
A Prairie Home Companion returning Saturdays at 6.
Small, natural food producers are merging with big conglomerates, provoking fears of selling out.
It's akin to selling out your soul to the devil.
But sometimes it works out well.
They've not only preserved the whole vision of the company, they've improved it.
When Big Food Buys Little Food, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekdays at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
WJCT and the Florida Theater are proud to bring me, Michael Feldman, and my show, What Do You Know, to the Florida Theater in Jacksonville on February 20th. We'll do the quiz, have some fun, enjoy the southern winter just a little bit. You bring the sunshine, I'll bring the sunscreen. Tickets available now at the Florida Theater box office by phone at 904-355-2787 or online at floridatheater.com.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, yesterday's Jaguars loss might be a turning point for the franchise.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper's here now, and Cole, you know, so many people are asking me, is Gus Bradley, does he have a future with this team after losing to Tampa?
I think it's a huge question, and I think we won't know that for sure unless we get inside Shad Khan's head and understand what his expectations are. But considering some of the things that were said when the season began, like Gus Bradley saying, this thing is built. It's built now. Well, it may be built, but it isn't running well. And there are obviously some real serious issues that have to be handled at some point here on the football side. The Jaguars lose 38-31 in Tampa, drops the Jaguars' record to 1-4 on the season. Gus Bradley said after the game that this one hurt. This was a game the Jaguars had to have when you look at the schedule. It was one of those few games that you could have said, hey, the Jaguars could have been considered a favorite. They weren't, by the way, according to Las Vegas. But on a day that Blake Bortles threw for 4 touchdown passes, the Jaguars still couldn't win. And after the game, we heard as emotional and maybe as fired up a Gus Bradley as we've heard. Now, this is a long cut that includes several different comments he made after the game, but I think it's important to get those words out.
I talk about, hey, we're after victory, we're after being our best. Well, that wasn't our best, and it's not acceptable, and that's the challenge. We got to dig deep and find out what these issues are and clean them up as soon as possible, because the expectation that we had in that locker room for this opportunity was not met. It does not feel like the bottom, but it feels like something's wrong in how we played. I feel bad for our fans. I don't know how many there are, 7,000? I mean, I saw them all up in the corner chanting, and we come out, and we don't play as well as we're capable of playing. Now, this time, it's real. I feel for them. When they come down like that, how can't you? And, that's what's disappointing as well, is I'm hoping that this setback shocks us to get things right, you know? And I'm hoping that is. I believe in these guys. I know. The reason I'm upset is they're capable of better. That's the reason I'm upset. I'm not upset because we're not very good. We're capable of being better, and we're not showing it. And that's what's frustrating. You say, hey, Gus, you said this was built. It is built. We've got enough good players in that locker room to do better than what we're doing on the field today. That's a fact. I've always tried to be honest with everybody, the fans and you guys, and that's how I'm feeling. Now, I don't know, maybe tomorrow I'll come back and go, well, I looked at things, but it's how I'm feeling right now.
And I think it's how a lot of fans are feeling right now. That you can say, hey, there are good enough players. You know, you can argue that. And if there are good enough players, then it's about the culture and the coaching. And I think that's really what the big question is right now is, do the Jaguars have the right culture to develop and win? Now, there have been some things that have, you know, been positive. Blake Bortles has played better. Some of the wide receiver play has been better. But at 1-4, the Jaguars have to be considered one of the worst teams in the league so far. Only the Detroit Lions have a worse record through five games. And this one hurts even more because a huge number of Jaguars fans traveled to Tampa Bay for the game. A bunch of Bold City Brigade members and other fans left Raymond James Stadium disappointed. And, I mean, you listen, when you invest that kind of not only money, but emotion into a team, you don't
absolutely
get the feedback.
It's
frustrating.
Yeah, terrible. And so not only Bradley, but what about Dave Caldwell's fate?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some whispers about Gus Bradley's future last week, and those whispers are growing louder. If the Jaguars don't get things figured out and fast, it's going to be Gus Bradley's last year as the head coach, and there's no guarantee about the security of general manager Dave Caldwell's position either. And you know, we don't have enough information to understand what kind of decision-making Shad Khan is going to, you know, what kind of litmus test Shad Khan is going to use here to determine whether it's coaching or GM or whatnot. One thing we can say is that in his first year of owning Fulham, the soccer team in England, he had three different coaches in the very same season. So he's been a lot more patient with his NFL coaching and general manager than he was with his soccer team.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I mean, part of it's the culture of soccer. You tend to have more turnover, and you can more easily change a coach in midseason and expect to get some results. In the NFL, very rarely do you change a coach in midseason and expect results. What you're doing is, if you just think, hey, this is not working, I'm going to make the move now and put somebody in there as sort of a caretaker and give yourself a jump start on finding the guy you really want for the next year.
Well, let's talk college football. Florida and Georgia going in a couple of different directions.
Yeah, the Gators, who were unranked 3-plus weeks ago, are now number 8 in the country after they beat Missouri 21-3. The Florida defense really playing well right now, and they'll be tested this week when they travel to Death Valley to face 6th-ranked LSU and probably the Heisman frontrunner, Leonard Fournette, the LSU running back. Georgia, on the other hand, going in the other direction, they're going to be tested the rest of the season without their best player, running back Nick Chubb, who sustained a horrific knee injury in Saturday's loss to Tennessee. Chubb's out for the year. He was a Heisman Trophy hopeful as well. Right now, Florida has the inside track on playing in the SEC championship game from the SEC East. What a far cry that is from what we were talking about the last several years.
Now, JU is undefeated, 5-0. That is so exciting.
Best start in school history.
Yeah.
And they, you know, Kerwin Bell and company made the claim that that was their goal, go undefeated, win every game.
How about that?
And so they've gotten off to a great start. Remember, they can now, from the Pioneer Football League, get into the what we used to call the 1AA, now the Football Championship Subdivision playoffs. And so they can get into the postseason if they continue this way. It's worked very well. You've got Cade Bell, Kerwin's son, the head coach's son at quarterback. He's been a 4-year starter, and he's having a terrific year, as is the Dolphin program. So when you've got Florida doing very well, Georgia in trouble, FSU keeps winning, but not all that impressively, and JU has been rolling. That's sort of the landscape of college football in the area.
And last but not least, bad night for the Armada.
Yeah, a rough soccer weekend. The Armada lose in North Carolina 3-0. 4 more games remaining, 3 at home. The Armada will likely need to win all of them to make the playoffs. Good news is the Armada have lost only once at home this year. And the U.S. men's national team, heartbreaking loss, 3-2 in front of over 90,000 at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. Probably more than half of the Mexican fans. Mexico scored less than 2 minutes remaining in extra time, so the U.S. will not play in the Confederations Cup in Russia. Hmm. And earlier in the day, the U.S. under-23s lost their chance to qualify for the Olympics. So it was not a good day for soccer in America.
Oh, well. Well, let's hope the Jaguars can finally win a game sometime soon. Always good to see you. In the meantime, follow Cole on Twitter, @ColePepper. See you next Monday.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Feedback always goes to this email, firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And never miss a show. You can subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Diane Rehm, the withdrawal of the leading candidate for Speaker of the House highlights major divisions in the Republican Party. What's next for GOP leadership and how the turmoil will impact critical budget deadlines and the 2016 elections? That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.